The following teaching is part 7 of a 33-part study of the Book of Colossians by Dr. Ken Boa.
Today we continue in the Book of Colossians, and we're going to be looking at some of the most important verses in all the Scriptures in the next couple times we teach this book. The ninth verse down to the, I would say really the 23rd or particularly critical verses from 9 to 23. And this whole section, verses 3 to 23, is really a thanksgiving section. But in this process, he thanks God not only for the faith of the Colossians and the spread of the gospel, but also for what God has done. And he prays and intercedes for them in this thanksgiving. And what we have right here that we're going to look at today, verses 9 to 14, in fact, is that prayer that he prays for them. Many of you know that this is one of the four life-changing prayers of the Apostle Paul that I have listed, and I've passed those out here before. We've talked about them before. If you want to have a list of those prayers on one sheet, you just go to the reflectionsministries.org website, and you can go under miscellaneous text resources, under that miscellaneous, and you'll find a variety of resources, including Paul's four life-changing prayers, which I strongly urge you to print out and carry with you. It'll be a one-sheet summary of the four key prayers in all the New Testament. And I promise you, you'll discover you're not praying that way, largely. You'll discover that most of our prayers, most of the way we pray, is actually not consistent with the way Paul prayed. And that's pretty revealing. So I will let you go through that exercise and discover that. My view then is that actually we can pray better for our loved ones than we actually do right now, because he's asking them better things than we usually ask for. We typically ask for health and wealth and healing and happiness, that sort of thing. No, that's good. Those are all good things. Paul, though, asked for a deeper thing, as we're going to see in this prayer. This is the kind of thing that he says is more fundamental. And everything comes out of this. Remember the distinction I keep making between hoping for something and hoping in something. These prayers deal with your hope in Christ. The other prayers are good, and they deal with the hope for something. We don't know if the hope fors will come, but don't make your hope in those things. So here are the things that we ought to pray for others and for ourselves. This particular prayer is one of those four. The others, as you'll see on the website, Philippians chapter 1 and Ephesians chapter 1 and also Ephesians chapter 3. You put these four together and they're a remarkable combination. So having thanked God for them, he then says that everything I do, he says, is in the context of prayer, so that as I write this epistle to you, I pray for you, even though he hadn't met most of them. He hadn't been to Colossae yet. Nevertheless, he says, speaking about the fact that they have grown in the knowledge of the truth, understood the grace of God in truth, and you recall we talked about faith, hope, and love, all animated by God's grace, and the idea of truth as being embedded in a person who is unchanging, and therefore we have an unchanging standard, an absolute for truth, which is a powerful anchor to hold on to in a culture of total relativism where it's just a moving target, true for you but not for me. That's the world in which we live. But the Scriptures always embed truth in a person. That person reveals propositions that are true, and his own person, his character, is unchanging and true. Having said that, then, Paul goes on to say, after speaking about, he informed us also of your love in the Spirit, speaking of Epaphras. Now, the prayer. For this reason, also, in other words, in view of all that we've just said, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding. I'm going to read you these verses. I want you to have it real fresh in your mind, the whole text. So that you will walk in a manner worthy of the Lord, to please him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, for the attaining of all steadfastness and patience, joyously giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. For he rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. That's the text. Now, let's just unpack a few of those verses, and I think we'll have enough time, I hope, as well, for some interaction on any of these things that raise questions. But right away, he starts and says, "We pray for you that you would be filled with the knowledge of his will." It's a very important notion. Many of you know that this is a word that could be translated real knowledge or true knowledge. The word gnosko in the Greek is different from the word oida. O-I-D-A, oida, is a word that speaks of intellectual apprehension. It's cognitive truth. But gnosko, G-I-N-O-S-K-O, that is a knowledge of a person or a relational knowledge or an experiential knowledge. That's the knowledge Paul prays for. Not that they just have head knowledge, but that they have heart knowledge. Now again, it's got to start with the head and go into the heart, because faith isn't based on ignorance. It's based upon knowledge. You see the idea? I think it was Ambrose Bierce who, in the Devil's Dictionary years ago, defined faith as believing without evidence in what is told by someone who has no knowledge about things that have no parallel. In other words, it's all la-la land, you see. The fact is that faith is not believing in what you know ain't so. It is, in fact, based upon the knowledge that's revealed to us, not by our senses, not by our minds, but by the Spirit of God, who reveals this third way of knowing God, truths that we could not know otherwise. And may I parenthetically say that in the spiritual realm, there is no knowledge without commitment. I want you to hear that. In the spiritual realm, there is no knowledge without commitment, not spiritual knowledge. Because spiritual knowledge is not achieved in the same way we would achieve knowledge of astronomy or calculus or biology or something like that. No, this knowledge is achieved really through the process of commitment in advance to what God will reveal, not only in our minds, but also the implications for our wills. I'll also stress that you cannot grow and really live effectively without knowledge. This knowledge is mediated by the Spirit of God, and then it is also empowered by our commitment, our volitional commitment, and then God works it in, and you create a context in which the Spirit of God works it into your life, and so it goes from the head to the heart. That's what he's after. You go from propositional truth, which is the head, into personal encounter, which is the heart. And that's the process. So his desire is always then for us to have a real knowledge of God. So he says, we pray that you would be filled with the knowledge of his will. So it's not just knowledge of God, but it's also of the divine will. It's very important for us to see this as well. In Islam, you can only know Allah's divine will. That's all you can know. You can't know Allah at all. Here, we can know the living God, and we can also know his will, you see. But knowing God is more than a matter of just surrender to his will. It is entrusting oneself to a loving person. You see, the difference there is radical. And in this concept, then, when you entrust yourself to him and get to know him personally, to know him, as we've said before, is to love him. The better you know him, the more you'll love him. And to love him is to trust him. You see the idea here? To love him is to be willing to trust him. Because you know, he always has your best interests at heart. And to trust him is to be willing to take the risk of obeying him. So knowledge leads to love, love to trust, trust to obedience, and obedience to fruit. So that the obedience leads to fruit bearing as well. So that there's always a practical outcome. There's a birthing process that starts from the inside and births itself into the outside by means of the actual starting with the work of the Spirit in the inner man, and then that working from the inside out until our actions are animated by the power of the Spirit. So that it begins to have a real effect, not just on you, but on people around you and the world in which you live, your arena of influence, whether it's your neighborhood, your business, your family, your friends. All those arenas of influence, then, can be affected profoundly by this kind of spiritual knowledge, this knowledge of his will. By the way, I want you to notice something again. This is just a process of meditation out loud. That's all I'm doing is meditating out loud. Really, seriously, it's all I'm doing. When you read the scriptures, to meditate is to ask questions. What does that text mean, knowledge of his will? You see the idea there? You're rolling it around. He says the knowledge of his will and all spiritual wisdom and understanding. Now, this word wisdom is a word that is rich with meaning because it's actually embedded in the wisdom literature, a whole tradition of literature that's found in the Hebrew Bible. And this wisdom literature always had to do with honing in on practical details of life, looking at the fine mesh of life, things that were too fine to really be hit by the broadsides of the prophets. This deals now with more specific details about money, about speech, about relationships, about listening, about using your time, about work, about parenting. This wisdom literature, then, is very specific, and it's always animated by the fear of the Lord. Whenever you connect wisdom, chokhmah, which means skill, that's what the Hebrew word has to do with practical skill, to apply the truth in a practical way. That's what he's talking about here. Our call is to take truth and to apply it in a meaningful and practical way. You do not learn wisdom in college. You know this. You never learn wisdom in college. Was it here that I told you about the Columbia University student who sued the university because the catalog said that they're going to train the student in wisdom? The guy sued the college. I didn't get any wisdom here. So it's one of those bogus lawsuits. But the point is that you're not going to get wisdom in your world. You understand that. We have factoids now. And there was a wisdom that led to knowledge, and the knowledge to information, and the information now has been reduced to factoids. You see the idea? The loss is great. So we have become more shallow, more superficial, and people in our culture live on the surface of life. Have you noticed that? They are surface, shallow thinkers, and therefore they're shallow livers because they don't have any depth. Where do you get this depth? Well, the wisdom literature teaches that this depth comes from a radical commitment to the lordship of Christ, which is the New Testament equivalent to the fear of God in many ways. There's an imagery here of radical commitment to the living God. It's a fear of God, and it's a fear of the divine displeasure, and furthermore, the fear of God is a desire to be pleasing Him, the other side of the coin, more than anything else. So they go together. And you will know what that is when you cross to the other side. Karen and I just saw, people either love it or hate it. We just saw the expanded edition of The Return of the Kings. It's a funny thing, you either love it or you hate it. We love it. And the expanded edition, gosh, I think that must push 4.5 hours now, that movie, just the third movie. And it has lots of little bits you didn't see before. But there's a couple magic moments, and one of those magic moments is when it looks like the end is there, and Minas Tirith is being destroyed, it seems, by these horrible Nazguls and these cave trolls and these armies of orcs and so forth, and everything looks like it's being destroyed. And at that moment, Gandalf speaks to Merry, and he communicates. He says, this looks like it's the end. He says, it's not so bad. He describes what that would be like as you go, you see in the distance these shores, white beaches, and beyond that, a beautiful green followed by a swift sunrise. It's a paraphrase of what he says. It's an image. It's not so bad. In fact, the best image there in the film is at the very end. When Gandalf and Bilbo go off on the Fair Havens to the uttermost west. It's the end of the Third Age, and the elves no longer have their dominion because the power of the ring has been destroyed, and consequently, they lose their power. They must leave this world. And the image of death is a beautiful image. It's a beautiful image of them getting on this boat and going across to the west, across the ocean, to a place that had never been visited. But it's really their home. And the beautiful thing in the movie is the way as they proceed off into the west, into the sunset, what happens is the image gets wider and wider and wider until you can no longer see it. And that, to me, is really an image of home. You see the idea? So Karen and I were talking about that, and she made an interesting comment last night when she said, you know, I would like to go there. I'd like to be with them. I said, you will be one day. And that's the truth. We will all head to those fair shores where home really awaits us. So what we have is what I would call a homesickness. Isn't that an idea? That you're homesick for a land you have not yet seen. You see, it's not homesick for somewhere you've been. It's homesick for a place you have not yet visited, you see. And that's what wisdom is about, is really being animated and empowered and motivated by the things that God says will be more than worth your while. So that when you see Him, then you will know that the fear of God was, in fact, the love of God and the desire to embrace His sovereign and yet loving initiatives as the sovereign and sacred romancer of your soul. So wisdom then has to do in this world, living today in the light of that day, living each today, because there's only two things you ever have. Would you agree with me? There's only two things. You only have God and now. That's really all you have. If you look at it this way, you only have those two things. You have God and you have now. Now, there are people in which you express that relationship in your life. There are things that we're called to do, tasks, labors. We're called to work while it is yet light. Night is coming when no one can work. We have a task. We have a purpose. We have a mission. But really, each moment, really what if you stripped it down to the bare essence, it would be that relationship which defines you and empowers you. And it would be this moment, which is all you ever have. All you ever have is the present moment. As you know, most men live in the future. The vast majority of men live in the future, don't they? I mean, that's where they always suppose that the future will make up for their present lack. And that's a terrible thing. What you need to do is treasure the now. That's all you ever have, because the future is not here and the past is gone. And you know what happens then when a person reaches retirement and then they suddenly they no longer live in the future? What do they do then? They live in the past. So they make this bizarre switch to nostalgia land. And their whole life they were never alive to the present, all they ever had. It's one of the things about childlikeness. A child lives in the now, doesn't he? That's why I never really was so thoughtful about the passing of time in some ways. I was immersed in it. When I would play, hours could go by and I wouldn't even notice it. You see the idea? Because you were so immersed in your present activity that that's why a kid can't be as bored as adults. As you know, Lewis made it very clear in the Screwtape Letters that the present tense is the closest thing we know to eternity, not the future. It's the present tense. That's the closest thing, because God lives in the eternal now, the eternal present. All the past and the future is who I am. And so Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, but He is always the I am in all times. Before Abraham was, I am. And that is a powerful picture. Of course, the Jews understood, the Pharisees understood that, and they took up stones to kill Him because He was claiming to be. They knew what He was claiming to be. The I am, the great I am that I am. And that was the name, as you recall, given to Moses, revealed to Moses, that he was to tell Pharaoh when he spoke to him, tell him that the I am is the one who has given me this message. So that is the one who is and who was and who will be, but who is always. So that he lives in all of the past and all the future in the present tense. For God, then, every moment is an eternity. But for God, eternity is a moment. You see, both are true. And there's a mystery there. Now, continuing on then, he talks about this will, spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that you will walk in a manner worthy of His will. Let me see. With wisdom and understanding. Now, the understanding, this is a term you were raising here, has to do, again, with a growth in moral understanding. It's not just intellectual. There's a moral and volitional understanding that relates to what I mentioned before, to commitment. So you will not understand spiritual truth beyond what your commitment level is. Do you see where I'm going with that idea? Your understanding will stop at the point when you stop obeying. Application is the key to transformation, and it's also the key to spiritual knowledge. So a man can stop applying, and they will stop learning, and God will not give them new information because He's the perfect pedagogue. A good pedagogue, a good teacher, knows when there's no more point in teaching new things unless the student grasps the prerequisite material. Why teach new stuff when you haven't got it down for the later? So, and what happens is He'll teach us the same thing over and over again, give us new opportunities to practice it. We screw up, He gives you new opportunity, but you can go around that circle as long as you want. until you finally catch on, you apply, then he moves on and gives you new light that you'll have to apply to. Apply. And of course, we don't know anything practically. The light that we have, the light that he would give us is too much, so he gives us little packets, discrete quanta, so that you will walk in a manner worthy of the Lord then. Speaking of this wisdom and understanding, you'll walk. That's what I've just said before. This has to do with application. Your walk is your outward life of obedience and application. In a manner worthy of the Lord, which means to be actually pleasing to Him. And that's really what this idea is. It's worthy. It's a worthy life. You and I can't please God. Those who are in the flesh, Paul says, cannot please God. Therefore, the only way you can please God is by being empowered by the Spirit of God, you see. Only when you're walking by the Spirit can you be pleasing to God. You cannot be pleasing to God on your own effort. It requires your dependence upon the Spirit of God to mediate the life of Christ in you and through you. And that's what this idea, and here's the neat part about this. He says, to please Him in all respects, bearing fruit in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. Do you see what you have? You have a virtuous cycle. We all know about vicious cycles, don't we? Where you go down and down and down, you diminish here, and then that affects this. And then your moral flaw here leads to a diminished wisdom, and that leads to another moral flaw, and you spiral downwards, don't you? But there's also the opposite, where you can have a virtuous cycle. Note the cycle. First he prays in verse 9 that they would have knowledge of his will. This knowledge will be birthed in a walk that bears fruit. This fruit, in turn, will lead to greater knowledge of God. Do you see the cycle there? Because increasing in the knowledge of God, as you come to know Him and then apply it, it leads to more knowledge. So it's a virtuous cycle upwards. That's the idea in this text. So it's a very powerful concept. Strengthened with all power. This is really an image, I think, of the Spirit's work in us, according to His glorious might, for the attaining of all steadfastness and patience. So this power, then, as we bear fruit in every good work, and we are called to bear fruit, good works are the outflow, the byproduct of intimacy with God. Good works by themselves are things that are not such that they lead to a saving relationship. They are the product of that relationship, and they are achieved in us and through us by our divine human cooperation, a kind of synergy. As we depend upon the Spirit of God, but use our physical and natural gifts as well. So it's a divine human process, these good works. Every one of us in this room has been called for good works which God's prepared for those to walk in. You are all given a mission for these things that will be worthy of God and pleasing to Him in your respective arenas of influence. And so he says, strengthen with power then, as we grow in this knowledge, according to His glorious might. It's His power, that is to say. The strengthening is passive, that is to say, it's all of Him, not of you. For the attaining of all steadfastness and patience. Now, that's an important idea. Why steadfastness and patience? Why do you suppose He throws those particular words in here in this process?
Time, and then God in His timing begins to do something.
Yeah, that patience, that kind of patience is virtuous because it's called in the Psalms, waiting on the Lord, waiting upon God. And God's timetable is never ours. We often have a vision in advance of its fulfillment. And then we have the vision, but we must not try to open doors that are not yet open, but we still have a vision of what that might be like. That's the idea. I would also say steadfastness and patience are required in a fallen world. And that's the issue here. You see, because you have been liberated here, but in this world, we require steadfastness and patience because you will be misunderstood in this world and surely in our culture. As I've told you many times before, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when the faithful follower of Christ becomes more and more marginalized in our culture. It's just going to happen. Yeah, little bit by bit. Yeah. And that's how it works. It's always kind of, it's like the water torture, drop by drop by drop, you see. And at first it's not painful, but it drives you nuts, one thing after another. So you require in this world, which is opposed to your growth, you do now understand the world, the flesh, and the devil are all hostile to your spiritual growth. All three forces are there, and all would keep you down. And all you need to do is stop pursuing and you will diminish. Just the way it is. You stop the pursuit and you will decline. I can actually finish this. Giving thanks to the Father, which is really in everything give thanks. Here's, in this case, the thanksgiving is because he's qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in life. That's a wonderful picture. There's a new exodus that he's describing here. In the former exodus, they were delivered from the bondage of Egypt and so forth. But this new exodus now is an exodus into the newness of God's land. The inheritance was regarded at first as the parceling of the land, but later they began to realize that there's a deeper spiritual meaning of this, that this inheritance is God. In fact, the Levites didn't have any land. Their inheritance was God. You see the idea. So this liberation can be lost, though. I would speak of this liberation in this way. A better, more modern analogy that'll help us see it would be the liberation that occurred at the end of the Second World War, with the victims in concentration camps, with the piled bodies, dead bodies, and the survivors with hollow eyes and frail bodies who were liberated. And that's a radical image here of being moved from bondage to freedom. But even there, many of those people still suffered stigma and so forth afterwards. It was not an easy course. You and I, too, have been liberated, but we still will experience adversity and a lack of full embrace. That's the stuff of the other shore. Now he goes and finally says, he rescued us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. So we are formerly in a domain of darkness where we were under the bondage of Satan. But now he's moved us from that realm into a new realm, the realm of light, the realm of grace, away from the realm of death and of sin and of sorrow, into the realm of life, light, and love, so that we receive this kingdom, and we are already enjoying the kingdom. It's now and not yet. The fullness of the kingdom has yet to be seen, but even now we live kingdom life. That's the idea. And so we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins, which means redemption, remember, is a word that means someone's paid a price to set a slave free. That's the issue. And so who were slaves to sin and death have now been set free through the price that was paid by another. And now we've been set free from the auction block of slavery and set free into the liberty of Christ. And so we have then the forgiveness of sins, which is our deepest need. Is to have forgiveness. Usually our problem is we can't forgive ourselves because we haven't embraced God's forgiveness of us.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.